Hey there, and we're back with another jam-packed edition of the Retro Computing Roundtable Podcast, show number 4. We're historians, enthusiasts, collectors, educators, authors, bloggers, podcasters, and more within the computer history community. I'm your host, David Grillish of ClassicComputing.com, where I blog and produce two other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast and Stan V's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. I'm broadcasting from the Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia. Let's all pull up around the table now and get started. And on today's show, we're joined by another great group of accomplished individuals. So first is our, one of our two first returning panelists. It's Bill Degnan from Landenburg, Pennsylvania. He teaches the History and Preservation of Historical Microcomputers class at the University of Delaware. He's also the Vice President of March, which is the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists.
Not the entire month, correct.
March operates a brick-and-mortar computer museum in Well, New Jersey, at a former Marconi Lab Army Signal Corps base that is now the InfoAge Science Center. March also hosts the annual Vintage Computer Festival East. So hello, Bill. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you.
And I'm pretty sure we covered this on the first show. So you're from Landenburg, Pennsylvania, but you spent a lot of your time in Delaware. Like
yeah,
your business is Delaware, and you're probably in Delaware right now, right?
Actually, no. I am in Landenburg.
Oh. Well, how's it been going since we talked last?
Well, I've been experimenting on the game called Life, the computer game Life. It's a simulator of various – it's an algorithm to try to reproduce the biologic effect on a computer grid, and I've been doing that on a PDP-8 computer to because that's where it was originally written, I think, or it was a very early version of it. Was done on the PDP series, so I wanted to get back as far as possible to see how it actually would have run on a PDP-8 in the speed and so on, the processing speed and capabilities of that machine. Lots of fun.
Yeah, you had sent me the video, and so I'll put a link in the show notes to your YouTube page. So that was pretty neat, and so you can watch what Bill's doing on a PDP-8, a terminal that is. And what kind of PDP-8 is it?
It's a PDP-8E.
So that's like the, it looks sort of like a big Altair or something like that, right?
Right, right. And I've also been using it to generate music. And I've seen a number of people do this already, but this is something that I wanted to do as well. So I've been recording various songs off of the AM radio and trying to get it to sound good because it's very staticky and difficult to control.
Are you able to play something now, like on your microphone there, or is it you have something in your YouTube videos?
I do have something in my YouTube videos. You can take a look at that. I was not sure exactly how I would. I can play it. I do have it queued up, but I'm not sure how it'll sound. So,
can you do it? Do a little bit.
Sure. I'll have it run in the background.
Sure.
There's a sample.
Yeah.
I'll give that one a rest. But you can see it's very airy sounding. It's difficult to control.
And I hope this is not a stupid question, but is the sound we just heard, I mean, that's coming from a speaker?
Yes. What that is it's coming from the AM radio speaker. So if you can
imagine, that's right. Okay.
It's like having a mini AM radio station in your computer room.
It's the same thing that happened with the Fool on the Hill with the Altair, right? The story from the Homebrew Computer Club.
Exactly, and I would assume that the PDP-8E or the PDP-8 was the inspiration to convince Steve Dompierre that it was possible to do on the Altair as well. So he certainly didn't invent it cold. Mm-hmm. He just realized that with the front panel switches, it would be possible also to do it on an Altair.
Okay. Well, I know you had said something about the radio, and I misunderstood. I guess I thought you were recording it from the radio. Yeah, on a PDP-8.
Right, no, it is actually, you actually hold the radio in front of the computer just right, just at the right station, and you can hear it. It's almost like the aliens are coming through your radio and taking over.
And this was one of the early problems with early microcomputers, and what is the agency that...
FCC.
There you go, right, FCC had a problem with that, where they, you know, they cracked
basically
down
it turned
on
out that they didn't have any attempts to shield from a lot of radiation or radio waves, and it just wasn't being covered. And then the FCC stepped in and said, oh yeah, this is actually our province, and you really have to do something. Mm-hmm. And what they usually did was they would spray a chemical on the inside to stop the waves from getting out. So it was like a hack job. And then over the later years, they changed the cases to be...
Yeah, just... around 1980 or so. That's when they phased out the TRS-80 Model 1, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they replaced it with the TRS-80 Model 3 because it wasn't compliant with the new regulations.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Again, so I'll put the links up to your YouTube page. You have a really nice YouTube page I hadn't seen, so I'll be wanting to check that out myself, a lot of your other videos. So next we have another return panelist. It's Earl Evans, and he hails from Portland, Oregon. He is the host of the RetroBits podcast. And Earl, you just had another episode come out, which was very enjoyable. I don't know if you heard me talking on the Retro Maccast, but we were just talking about what a pro you are.
I appreciate you saying
from
that.
Just doing a show, you know, where it's just you, and you're just great at it. It's really great listening to you. But welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be back on the show. Fun to be back on here with you and with Bill, and also exciting to get another chance here to chat with Jason. I had the chance to meet Jason when he was in town. Two or three months ago, Jason?
Yeah, it would be probably during the September run. And
yeah, so, for the Jet Lamp tour when you were. That was an absolutely fantastic presentation. Fun to meet you in person. So, yeah, I just finished the Commodore 64 series that I was doing on RetroBits. That was fun. Part three was talking about some of the third-party software and hardware that was out there for the Commodore. There was lots of stuff, obviously, 100,000 different software packages they made for the Commodore 64 over its life. But so, yeah, it's tough when you're talking about something like the Apple II or the Commodore 64, you know, the super popular models. How do you cover everything? I mean, I practically could have gone on forever, but tried to hit the highlights and had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up about meeting Jason and him presenting. And what is the name of the Commodore user group there in Portland?
We've got two.
Okay.
Actually, there's the Commodore Computer Club and there's the PDX Commodore Club. And both of them, you can get information out there on the internet. And so it's actually, you know, twice a month I can get out to Commodore activities here in my own backyard. And we do a lot of exciting stuff and have a lot of fun.
That's amazing. I mean, they have two of them there.
And it is. It's pretty cool.
Did you guys get together when Jason did the Get Lamp? Did you guys like join up to do one show or whatever? Or?
They were both there. How about that?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, you can find the video feed of Jason's talk mm-hmm. that he did out on Vimeo, I think is where it's hosted. So I'm on there for just a couple minutes. I did the introduction. And that was a lot of fun. And that actually was the official club meeting of one of the clubs for that month. And we met at a nice location in Portland. It was a great setup. It had a nice big video projector and
it looked like it.
Had a lot of fun.
I envy you that you have, you know, a club like that there, the Commodore Club. So I'm trying to do something like that in the Atlanta area. Of course, it won't just be Commodore, just be the, you know, retro computer sort of club.
Mm-hmm.
So okay.
How's that coming along?
Slowly, but actually I've had some good responses lately. I guess I've mentioned somewhere recently that I was trying to get a group going at where I work, and it just wasn't a good venue. And I had like three people the first time, and I recognize it takes time, but I didn't have anybody the second meeting. So I decided to kind of put that off, and so I created a Yahoo group, kind of like what March has, and so I'm kind of doing a grassroots, slowly get people into that until I can get like a core group of even just a few people very interested, and then maybe we could start a meeting. Even if it's in my living room or a restaurant or something, you know, and then just work from there. Find a venue where we can actually bring stuff in. So kind of going to move a little slower with it. Had a couple of people email me local now that seem very interested, so that's exciting.
Cool.
I wanted to add that we just had our Christmas party for March. And we had a number of people, I don't know if 20 or 30 people showed up in Wall, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So once it gets going, they are successful. And we're also hosting workshops at my office in Wilmington, and we get together, for those who like the technical stuff, to get together and work on computer projects. And then those that like to get together and more have fun and talk about computers, you have the get-together parties that we have every quarter or so.
Yeah, and I highly recommend anybody to be involved with March. So I'm a member of March, but now I'm not local to that region, the Mid-Atlantic region, so I'm not a local member. I can't participate in some of the local stuff, but I'm a member. And so March is a inspiration for me to try to do essentially the same thing here in my area, the Southeast, mm-hmm. so the greater Atlanta area. So, yeah, you guys are doing all kinds of fun stuff. I just looked at the recent pictures of, now I'm trying to remember, what was that? Was that your Christmas party, I guess? Yeah, with the movies and, what you're talking about. Yeah, it looked like a lot of
fun. It's like a swap meet and a little bit of fixing going on and, drinking beer and, watching movies and everything. We, people will bring their favorite, nerdy movies.
Oh, we'll have none of that, Bill. It's all business in my group. I'm only kidding. All right, well, next up is Jason Scott. So I guess Jason's the biggest celebrity in the retro computing community. So he hails from Hopewell Junction, New York, and he is the producer of the GitLamp documentary that came out recently, as well as the BBS documentary. They're both available on DVD. He has also run TextFiles.com for many years. And so, Jason, welcome, and how are you doing?
Well, celebrity is an interesting classification. there's a lot of celebrities for me in the retro computer. I mean, that's the rub, right? Celebrities in the retro computing culture.
Right.
But the thing is that the retro computing culture is very, very lucky because, like, for all of its aspects of, cultishness and people being interested in things and not everyone understanding, so many of the people who formed what's important to us are part of the community still. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so rare, right, that you could actually have somebody that's into old cars and the guy who invented the cars shows up all the time. And here we're so lucky because we get people like Wozniak who show up and are like, oh, yeah, hi, what's up? Oh, did you like that? Oh, thanks. As opposed to we all dream of what that person may have thought. So for me, there's better celebrities because they actually did stuff. I'm just collecting what other people did.
Well, I think you're definitely a key celebrity in the computer of those of us that are, all of us here that are computer historians. Now, obviously, Steve Wozniak is a celebrity, right? He's the guy that was there and doing the stuff versus we're the fanboys. Is that fair?
I'll take many different titles as people want to give me, and fanboy is one I've been given a few times. And
okay. I don't particularly like that term, but it's not too bad.
I think that's an important distinction. There are a lot of people that I've come across who would contact me because they have something that they want to donate to a museum who aren't necessarily famous or weren't famous then, but when you talk to them, you realize how anonymously but how wonderfully they worked in the 70s or the 60s on something. And they may be the only ones that have a certain knowledge of a piece of software or hardware or where it was developed. And these people, they might not be famous, but they are certainly out there, and it's important to interview them or talk to them or, listen and work with them. And there's a number of people who show up to the workshops actually remember how to do the restoration work.
Yes, exactly. And I'd like to promote something I just completed, and it's an interview I did with a man named Steve Smith. He's from Nashville, Tennessee. And I acquired a computer from him recently. I'm in the Atlanta area, and it's one of the last Altairs made, that's built into a desk. And so this man worked for Southwestern. I'm always afraid I'm going to get this wrong. It's not South Central Bell. There we go. That's the company. So I was about to say the wrong one. So he, acquired this computer for the Bell company, programmed it, made it work, and it has a fantastic story to tell. So I just finally completed editing, and that's posted now. And on iTunes, that interview with him. So, yeah, he's someone that's, not a celebrity, if you will, or, just a person that actually used the equipment. So it's awesome to capture his story to go with this machine, which I truly hope will end up in a museum one day. I mean, it will end up in a museum one day because it's rare. So if you guys haven't seen that, please check it out because I have the pictures, there and everything too. Back to Jason. So, I wanted to ask you, Jason.
Sure.
I've seen some pictures of you, and so is this your basement, these pictures of you, where you have, like, the stoned walls and stuff? And you have some old computers in there? And
Right. There's a couple pictures. I no longer live in that house. I moved out last year. I actually live in New York now. That's actually in Massachusetts.
Okay.
I have a silly reason why most people don't know I've moved to New York, which is that I have an extremely famous cat on the internet.
Wow.
Twitter.com/Sockington. He is the 150th most followed account. He has been covered in national press. And so it was actually a problematic story that I would leave that house. And he wouldn't, and so as a result, it's not really known that I moved to New York. But I did move to New York. I now live out on a piece of land in just outside of New York City, where there is now a shipping container, 40 foot long, of computer history that I have.
Okay.
So it's actually large. It's more stuff, but it doesn't have that beautiful 100-year-old stonework, which is what you're seeing in that photo. But I shot a music video in that area. I have pretty much everything that's in that basement. Some of it I have actually, believe it or not, donated to places as I thought they needed them. And now I have even more stuff in other areas because people think of me when they want to get rid of some computer history that they're not sure they should keep. And like just recently, if you want an example of how crazy things get, and how obscure sometimes. I just recently took delivery of 79 boxes of legal documents, which for various reasons I hadn't been warned were coming that day. And what they are is the somewhat celebrated 2000-era DECSS case, the case where people were being sued for coming up with how to unscramble DVDs.
Okay.
And all of that brought in all of these records of IRC conversations, of hacking sites, of hackers, and all of these related materials. And basically, the Electronic Frontier Foundation had been storing it for 10 years. We're about to pulp it, to shred it. And 2600, who were one of the defendants, said, no, 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 you should send it to Jason Scott. So they arrived here, and I don't have the room for them. So on Monday, I've rented a truck, and I'm driving them to Maryland, where another hacker group is going to take them and scan them and put them online.
Wow.
So I'm, you know, the part of the thing is sometimes people look at someone like me who has a lot of stuff and says, well, he's a hoarder. He's just hoarding. He's collecting. And sometimes I'm not. I'm just making sure that that critical step between what do I do with it and somebody else going, oh, we could use that, is not a trash can. Because that's the biggest problem. You'll find out these stories where people had something that was historically interesting,
right,
but they didn't know what to do with it. And so away it went. And then later someone goes, oh, that's a shame. I try to bridge that little gap in everything I do.
Can I use that, Jason, when people ask me?
What now?
Can I use that line when people ask me?
Yes. Feel free to justify our behavior in any way you wish by quoting anyone you want to. And, more than once I have had to talk about, you know, professional archives. And my personal opinion is I estimate it'll be about 2020 to 2025 before what we think of as established archives really recognize the value of computer history for real, like where it doesn't become a topic of hot conversation around the board that somebody wants to save some computer history. It'll just happen or not happen. It'll be a funding issue, not a will issue. And the problem is that it's if we don't have people like us, just a bunch of lay people who don't have necessarily professional archiving credentials doing this, by the time they go, oh, of course we'll want this, it's going to be whatever happened to survive to that point, which will be a tiny percentage. This
right.
is the problem they had with film, right, where they just kind of let it die for years and years until somebody said, ooh, and I'm trying to avoid that this time. I'm doing my best. So that's the big gap. That's the thing going on. We're in this weird period, and people are going to listen to us in 50 years and be like, really? People are debating keeping this?
Right. Well, you know,
the Haley Museum in Delaware has a very good paper archive. they've been doing that since the 60s or 70s, since the IBM cases of the 70s. They have a lot of that documentation, paper documentation saved.
Right.
Maybe they would be interested in something like this. I don't know.
Well, we're not. It's interesting because where would this thing go? There's a chance that it may go into a law library where they keep celebrated historical cases.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what they have. They have an archive of computer-related. Why? I don't know. But they have an archive of computer-related legal documents for some reason.
Because somebody who did something with computers had an awesome time at that institution and wanted to do something, a lot of times is what it is. And the thing with me is I appreciate that and I want something like that to happen, but I find sometimes they move at a rather, by my standards, glacial pace. So it'll be like a year of discussion. And I always like to make sure that it's, you know, safely squirreled away and everyone knows where to reach it. But anyway, yeah, like that's a good example of just out of nowhere. You're going to have a whole range of people who go, really? That kind of stuff needs to be kept. And then you have other people who go, of course it needs to be kept.
Right.
So,
but I think
I don't
the majority of people, they consider, obviously, things like that. That's probably legal documents. I mean, they had to save it for a certain amount of time. But especially, I guess I think of like personal computers and microcomputers, especially when I started collecting some years ago, it's just pure trash.
Right.
You know, and then or even if they go through the trouble of giving it to a thrift store, as, and I'm not going to name especially some of the bigger, well-known ones, they're still trash because they're not going to mess around with it. A lot of the bigger ones now, they'll just ship it over to one place and then tear it all apart, you know, and
right.
quote-unquote recycle it. And
yeah, a lot of times the most important thing to them is the gold and the contacts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a lot of cases where if it ends up in the wrong place, it's used as – basically raw material. It's not perceived as having any historical context. But, you know, to take it out for 1 second, because you know me, I love talking, for 1 second, there is an entire community with websites, auctions, and once you know about it, you can find it for glass insulation from power lines and telegraph lines.
I have a few here in my house that my grandfather gave me because he collected some of them.
See, I used that as an example with computer people to go, this is what you need to understand. Like, if you go look at the glass insulation, the feelings you have are the feelings of people who don't collect computers. So you have to learn to speak to that, because if you try to justify glass insulator collection, you'll fall into a lot of the same arguments. Historically interesting, unusual variation. Mm-hmm. This was a fascinating part of our human history. And if you don't know that people are going to need to be convinced of that, it's a lot harder than just to go, it's all mine and I'm going to keep it because I'm afraid to throw it out, which is what they're thinking you're thinking.
Right, right.
So, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, just to get rid of the Jason part of the script, I created the movie Get Lamp, which is about text adventures. The previous one was called BBS.
Editor's note. Sorry, everyone. A little technical difficulty this podcast, as Skype dropped out on me twice, so this is the first instance. I rejoin us now after I've established the call again and recording.
Up at about 6 o'clock in the morning to make your connection so you could work.
What the BBS people call it, Jason, 13-year-old who got a modem for Christmas?
Right.
Yes.
That was terrible during those first few years when the World Wide Web replaced the BBS trying to work.
And don't hate me, but I was an AOL user
in
that time frame.
I sure the heck got out of being a hater of it. I'm just like, hooray, you even remember this period of time. That means you're still in good health. Congratulations. So you know, it's funny because I'm being interviewed for a social network documentary of some sort from the BBC.
Cool.
And I tell them about how in my research I was able to plug the the death of BBS's down to a month, like basically February 1995.
Yeah, I remember that. It's like I really do remember that. I remember not. I wouldn't say February 95, but I remember realizing in 95 that was it, and I quit my job and
right.
Completely changed my life. That year was the year.
Right, but I am saying objectively through the years of research, I determined it was February 1995. That's
that
what's
one,
so
yeah.
weird. Because
yeah.
And I was trying to figure out why, And the main reason is trumpet windsock. Because from that point on, if you put in front of somebody, oh, you used to call around and get BBSs? Oh, that's nice. If you install this, you will get multiple windows of connections open to multiple sites at once and communicate with all of them. And you can file transfer in one window while also communicating in the other. And everyone went, oh. And they never, ever, ever would call another BBS. And all these businesses I talked to, that's when the orders literally dropped to zero for new BBS products. And it's just amazing. And it just happens to work out that way.
I thought the trumpet windsock came out, though, a little earlier.
It did. But that's, as far as I can determine, one of the main conflagration of events. Like, it gets wildly adapted. You know, just like Adventure gets pulled in because DECUS, the Digital Equipment Computer Users Group, spreads it around. And suddenly it's everywhere. It's like something happened with trumpet windsock. And it just happened to hit where it hit that critical mass that day. Anyway, it's one of those things where you look back, and again, the only reason we have this knowledge is because I was able to find all other people who had historical stuff and go out and speak to them and stuff. And anyway, we should get back. Where was I? I was saying something really...
Well, you mentioned about your two documentaries for sale on DVD.
Oh, yes.
And actually, I think you had cut out a little bit there. So there's the Get Lamp, the recent documentary, and then the BBS, the documentary, which was that 2005 when it came out, that one?
Yeah, 2005 May, and GitLamp came out in July of 2010, mm-hmm. Which means that I really take a while to make documentaries, and both of them have done very well for what they are, and I've sold thousands of each.
Good. Have you already chosen a new project yet?
You know, it's funny. I have some ideas, and believe me, a lot of other people have ideas. I have some ideas, and basically the only way I could pay for them at this point is with a Kickstarter.com funding round. And I'm probably going to ask for quite a bit of money because I discovered these things cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain it, and I'll say, if you want me to do this, hooray. If not, I understand. But I have to know beforehand now because I just simply can't speculatively – like I knew – a BBS documentary was going to be wanted. And I knew a text adventure documentary was going to be wanted. You know, I can say that what I'll be doing is I'll be announcing two simultaneous products, one that would come out in a few years and one that would come out more frequently because I think people would want that kind of feedback. And that one would be about arcades. The more frequent one would be like almost like think of it as a short web series. That eventually I would release on whatever represents release media. But when I say arcades, I don't mean we really don't need another documentary with shots of blinking lights and Pac-Man fever playing in the background. What I'm talking about is the actual space, the fact that for 400 years, people are like, well, what would it cover? And I'm like, well, we'd probably start in 16th century Austrian automaton lounges and probably go forward to MAME. And the idea is, why do we as a species like to have rooms in which we pay money to have fun with machines and all of that representation? And that's what I would do. And I would do like short, like 20-minute episodes on some aspect of arcades. Like everyone will talk to somebody who created a video game about, oh, did you like making the video game? Yeah. They make more video games now. Yeah. They still play yours. Yeah.
And, you know what? I already have the answer to that question, though. I know why. It's the same reason, like, first thing comes to mind, every good user group I've ever went to over the years, the best ones always happened in restaurants. Because even though you're there to talk to people and interact, it's always better if you have something fun to do as well. So, like, eating and drinking makes it, enhances the social aspect. Game rooms are kind of the same thing. Even though you're, obviously, in a game room, you're playing, you're not talking as much, but you're still socializing. So having something fun to socialize in. Am I on the right track, you think?
I definitely know that with the BBS documentary, the number one surprise, which once you hear it, you can convince yourself it wasn't a surprise, is to these people, when I interview people about their memories of using computers, all of them are in the context of human relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, you can build up this mythos that, oh, these people are working in singularity and nobody's paying any attention to them and they're alone and bitter. And it's all wrong. all the greatest memories I get from people was when, having used the bulletin board system, they went to a pizza place and hung out with their friends, or somebody they met on there said, you know, I don't know you that well, but look, let's go to the mall because there's a Radio Shack and we can go to the Radio Shack together. And they went and became friends for life, and or they met their wife through it, or they, you know, and so on. All these stories are the context of human interaction. So similarly, arcades, which are selections of machines, sometimes their strongest aspect is the fact that there were other human beings there with you. And so, yeah, no, that's the big secret. Right, that's in all of my documentaries. Is you very quickly realize, oh, these are primarily about people, and it's like, yes, that's why I interviewed people and not machines.
But Jason, just remember though, if you know, if the worst happens, if you do become a washed-up documentary maker, then the Retro Computing Roundtable can always be your Match Game 75.
Exactly. My future, I could be the Charles Nelson Reilly of the retro computing world.
I'll take Jason Scott for the win.
Right. Oh, man.
All right, we're going to move along to our items of interest in the news. So the first thing we have up is something that was tweeted by Blake Patterson, Blake Spot on Twitter, and he actually retweeted from Paul Kano, and it's a picture called 16-Bit Memories, and it's a CG work, and have any of you looked at this?
My cousin sent it to me on Facebook, and I was like, oh, that's a nice photo setup somebody did.
Yeah.
But it's pretty recent.
It looks real.
And I just simply said, oh, well, you know, it's nice that somebody did that. I wonder what it's in promotion of, because it was a little bit too, you know, set up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's cute. You know, somebody did that. Must be for some magazine. Nice. They'll do some article. And I just found out it was CG just today. When your link said CG, mm-hmm. So good job, person.
I like the idea that this would have been a Christmas present, and they took their Commodore 64 and took it off the table.
Yeah, behind, in the background,
and now they have the Amiga, and that was the message that I got from it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, there's a beautiful, you know, the best photos just grab your eye, and then the longer you look at them, the story becomes obvious, like the idea, like especially if it's really done well and it's not just to get. So yeah, I mean, the fact that it is showing that the Amiga is here, and the idea that yes, it's definitely Christmas, which is only indicated if you look at it in like one little area.
What's funny about it is the artist, and I'm trying to see where that is, but I read a little bit about this, that the artist said he didn't actually own an Amiga, he owned an Atari. And I think if you look right to the upper left of the display of the Amiga, you see there's a picture of a 520 ST, I think.
Yep.
So I believe that's what the artist said he actually owned, and his friend had the Amiga, but the Amiga had such better graphics and sound that he decided to, you know, to do the picture with the Amiga out of respect. But what's interesting is it's all like photorealistic, except for what I can tell is the little army guys. There's like even a little army guy that's like broken out of the display. And,
right.
And they're doing stuff like they're alive or whatever.
Right, that's what I mean. I thought those were realistically sculpted little things to promote something.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they're the elves that are getting it ready for when he wakes up in the morning for Christmas.
No. Oh.
The army elves.
Yes. So, the name of the artist is, and you know we're going to get this wrong, right? Tony Bratinovic. Somewhere he's like, oh, thanks, guys. Let's go interstation3d.com. This guy has a portfolio of digital graphics, so you could see some of the work he's worked on. He's obviously not just done this one piece of work. This is obviously his most recent work that got some attention, but he's done a whole bunch of other ones.
I see. The army guys came through the screen on the side. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's so awesome, I guess is what I was going to say, and realistic. The only thing, and you know, everybody's a critic, so put the guy down at all, but out the window, that doesn't quite look real, though, out the window. To me, it looks like a Christmas card sort of picture, but, you know, whatever, it's fine. It still looks pretty cool, everything.
You see, to me, that's the thing is that's where your brain goes. Your brain, angry it's been fooled, mm-hmm. now starts to find any flaws. Well, you should have known that. And the thing is I happen to like that, what he's doing there, and in a photo shoot, that is exactly what they would do. They would stick a blue light behind it, and if you go look at like old computer magazines, if they portray this kind of a thing, that's a common conceit. is the snow glows a crazy blue to represent moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's again, to me, that's why. I mean, to me, it was all
everybody knows that Back to the Future did not come out until after the Amiga was delivered. And obviously, that's a 1987 joystick. I'm just kidding. I'm making this up. And Cannon Fodder was not produced until 1988.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can get real nitpicky about everything. But it's a cool picture.
It's a beautiful picture. And the thing is, like I said, it's just, you know, it's really, really just all around done well. Like, it's just a beautiful piece of work. So, yeah, anyone who's listening, guess what? There's homework, Interstation 3D. And check that thing out because this guy's really good.
And
do they talk
at
all over on the website about what kind of tools he uses? I mean, I guess this is a nerd in me coming out, but I've played a bit with Blender 3D, the open source 3D modeling package. And I was looking at this, and, you know, the attention to detail in here is just amazing, and the perspective. And I'm wondering what sort of, you know, combination of hand art versus computing tools they use to produce this. I'll head over to the site and see if there's any insight there.
Yeah, he certainly gives some thought about like tools that he's used, but he probably here does not go into great detail. But I'm sure it's trivial to find what forum people went crazy over, and he showed up and he was like, "Well, actually, this." Mm. And what you tend to find is the numbers always flip people out because they'll be like, "This is pretty good. What'd you spend on it?" And someone will be like, "Oh, I don't know, 400 hours."
Like they'll
drop a number like that, and you'll be like, "Oh!" Like you'll find out they started working on it last Christmas.
Well, our next item is from Michael Nado, who's one of our panelists as well, and so he tweeted about a game collection of the late Dungeons and Dragons creator E. Gary Gygax. I guess I'm saying his name right.
Mm-hmm.
And most of his games here is listed on the website, so there's a link in the show notes. But a lot of them are, I guess, TSR games. So I don't know if ain't particularly that significant. You know, the guy is significant in what he made, whether or not there's some, you know, comments here. There's nothing particularly real rare. But
The notable thing, I guess the two notable things, is the whole thing is in towards a fund, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I've read there. So it's basically you're funding something related to him.
Oh, right, Gygax Memorial Fund, and his widow is signing some of these things, and certificates of authenticity, as well as you get an image of his signature stamp.
Right. So it's to me, it's less predatory and more an excellent fundraising technique to bring attention to producing a memorial for the guy. And the fact is, I mean, if you look at some of the items, they're sealed in box. I mean, he never looked at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, or he looked at them and was like, "Oh, awesome, thanks," and then put them somewhere in the basement, and so some of them are like not particularly.
Someone else thought he should have it, and so he had it.
He didn't sit by the fire lovingly staring at this deck of cards, and now you too will stare and think of the two souls bridged across the years. Instead, you're helping his widow help a really influential man be. You know,
and I hadn't heard anything about his death. I mean, I don't know how long ago. I didn't look that up.
March 4th of 2008.
Wow. So Dungeons and Dragons was pretty significant and pioneering.
Right. He basically what happened is that it was discovered that he had a flaw in his heart. And it was the kind of flaw where they were like, yeah, can't fix it, could kind of go off at any time. And he lived under that for a good number of years. And then one day it caught up with him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for years and years he knew this, and he still went to events and did interviews and shows and things. So it was one of those things where it just kind of went up, and then there was a huge burst of memories and comments on him and everything else, and that's where it stood. And so that was a couple years ago. So I guess this is the next step that his widow has decided to take.
Any of you guys play Dungeons and Dragons back in the day? The real one, as well as I guess there was many, many computer versions and variations.
there is great debate about the real one.
I misspoke. How about the original one? Maybe that's what I should have said. Nobody?
It's not a genre that I ever got into of gaming. I had some friends in mm-hmm. school who were extreme enthusiasts about the game, and I got to hear a lot about it and the strategy of it and the fun of it, but never actually what's the past tense for partake?
Partook.
I never did it.
I played faithfully every at least once a week for years with a group of friends of mine in high school, early high school. And what happened was we played for a while and we got very into it, got all the dice, got all the things, and started inviting one girl over, another girl over, and then after a while it was no more Dungeons and Dragons. so that was a good thing to do, you know, in 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th grade, and then it kind of turned into
who knew
stuff.
So
D&D gets you chicks?
Yeah, wow. Good job.
We need girls because, you know, we need them to play this or that character, and, you know, eventually.
That's a good line. We need
now
to
I'm
play
seeing
this.
The error of my ways.
I even wrote a dungeon, and the secret to it was you had to know to dive into a small pond, and then in the pond was an opening to the cave that you would go through and then get to the gold treasure. So you're basically running around the dungeon the whole time and in a cave complex, kind of like the text adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in a lot of ways what Dungeons & Dragons is a text adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in many ways. Jason, what do you think?
Well, I mean, text adventures? Surely, Jason, you've heard about these. Really? They let you play Dungeons
Door
& Dragons
for
on
you.
The computer. Yeah, exactly. I did not play. I bought all the books. And I designed dungeons, and I never played them with anyone. I just didn't have that kind of social fabric community.
I played a few times, and then I also bought, like, what was it, the Dungeon Master Manual? There was a Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Manual, I guess, or what?
Yep.
And then Monster's Manual, like the three main books.
Right.
So I bought those, and I did some designing and some other stuff, and then I never got to play, you know, what I did.
Right,
I
bought them just because they were
cool books,
fascinating books. Yeah, and you'd go to I'd go to KB Toy and Hobby, which was the place where I would find them, and there were these beautifully presented books, and inside were it's funny because you know in life you'll run into something that exists in other formats, right? But what gets you first, like you bump into first, you feel it's the greatest thing ever. And you're either annoyed by the others or you go, oh, yeah, I guess there was that. But for me, that was my first real interaction with elaborate world building and seeing it was like none of these things really existed. And yet they knew everything about them. And that was just an amazing cognitive thing to me of like, really? There's slime that looks like a table that could kill you? And here's how much it hurts? And you can find it here in these places I've never heard of? And, you know, that level of, like, imagination was, I think, what really attracted me as a kid.
And
was
he was obviously inspired by the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy, so it was definitely a connection. It was almost taking the book series and turning it into a game.
Right, and without wandering too far into this, there is huge debate over who did what, where, what things, stuff, their legal stuff. There's a really hilarious story involving a hot tub and a handgun, and there's all these really funny, great things in this history of D&D. But without a doubt, this man is a critical part of it, and it's a nice thing that they've found a way to reach out to fans in a way that fundraises for him and his memory. That I hope will really, you know, work out. So,
and
let's
just
hope.
To close off this topic and doing some Christmas shopping. So I was just at Borders recently, and in fact, I was just kind of looking at the. I guess you know, there's the advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and there's the basic, which comes in like a sort of a board game box. You know, so it's a starter version. So I was just looking at that, where there's it just got updated again. I guess this year, 2010, and debating maybe you know $25. Maybe I could buy that and try it out with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't bought it yet, so.
Yeah, I was really, you know, and I do have to say this. I of course collect other geeky documentaries because I'm always fascinated how it worked. And there's several Dungeons & Dragons documentaries that I have, including Life with the Dice Bag, which is wonderful, and Uber Goobers, which is another wonderfully created one, and so on. And one of the things that's interesting is when Wizards of the Coast buys basically the TSR assets, one of the main reasons given was because there was a limit on how many levels your character could be, and the head of Wizards of the Coast says basically, I have a 40 level, and I want him to be canon. So somehow the pure megalomaniacal geekiness of that, I'm going to buy that company, I'm going to change that rule, just struck me.
So I'm on top.
As a summit of geekdom. So anyway.
All right, well, moving along. See, this is another tweet by Blake Patterson, who's retweeting by – I used to listen to Victor's podcast. What's it called? It's a Macintosh podcast. Victor Caligiejo? I can't say it. But anyway, you guys have probably seen this. This has come up in the news a few times, but it's the company Commodore. You know, they bought the rights to the name. They had announced, I don't know, earlier in the year where they basically rebranded a sort of all-in-one keyboard computer as a Commodore. But now they're actually recreating the Commodore 64 as far as the case as close as possible, and then it has a PC inside of it. And I have to admit, that's at least kind of cool. I mean,
I love this. I here's the thing. We've seen over the years since Commodore went belly up the various attempts to revive the Commodore brand. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether this particular attempt will be successful or not, but the one thing I would love to see is for this Commodore 64 PC-compatible replica here to ship. It would just be cool to see it actually make it out the door. It's fun to see the pictures. It's fun to read about what they've got planned, but all the flailing attempts to get this and that and the other out the door with the revival of the Commodore brand, you know, a lot of them have either failed to ever actually produce anything, or what they did produce wasn't all that exciting. If they can get a mini ATX PC out there that's in the old Commodore 64 bread box case, I think that will be cool. I don't know, when you think about things like ergonomics, is it really a great angle to be typing on? I mean, you know, they weren't thinking about that stuff in 1982, 83, right?
That's actually one of the features they talk about in this, is that the where does it say it about the keyboard? It says a keyboard better than the original. But I hear what you're saying. It's still not that ergonomic, the shape.
Right.
But with a lovely IBM classic mechanism and click sound.
It sounds like an exciting product. I think I would probably try and save up the pennies in my piggy bank to get one of these. But
and they don't have any information on how much it'll cost.
I actually called them. I don't know if I had mentioned that to you earlier, but I did actually call them to talk to them about it.
What'd you find out?
Well, they're just getting things rolling. As I had asked them about, you know, what would be involved with being a distributor, or, you know, how that, because I have the computer shop and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious about it. They didn't have enough information. So I think it's in prototype stage, although it may be done now. And they, of course, are like the fifth company that's attempted this since whenever Amiga, you know, sold off the rights or whenever that happened.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure these are CG pictures.
Oh, they are.
Though I can't find it on their website, but in researching this and getting the show notes together, or, you know, our show document together, I also found some pictures of molds. And I don't know where those came from.
I saw that on a tweet.
Yeah.
They had some actual plastic moldings with the motherboard inside. I mean, it was real stuff, not the CG stuff that you're seeing here.
So if you could collect them, then you could get the prototype.
One factoid I love to tell people is, you know, the Commodore 64 is the world's best-selling computer.
There are more of them out there than anything else.
Right, because they didn't change the spec for over 20 years, for 11 years, was it, right? Or 13, something like that.
What, 82 to, like, they redesigned it in, I don't know, 89 or 90? But it still was, around.
Right, essentially it was around, so it's the world's best-selling computer. So there's already a market, so there's no debate there.
And you can get them all day long for, like, $20 or even given to you if you try a little bit.
I've been on boards where people will put up pictures from Europe, and there's one that was obviously taken with a high-quality digital camera, so I know it's taken in the last couple of years, and it's some restaurant, and someone's taken a picture of their point-of-sale system in some bar, and it's a Commodore 64 hooked up to a flat-screen monitor through some hack.
And
basically, it's obviously their point-of-sale, and it's got little color keys on it, and it's just going to sit there and live that way forever. And so, yeah, it's got a lot of cachet. I think my heart stopped really paying too much attention to all this when the proposed Commodore 64 MP3 player was announced. I was like, okay, great. You know, at that point, it's like what they call necro branding, where literally it's like, this has nothing to do with anything. You're just going to like the logo. So we're going to slap it.
Those things, that's true. But with this, you've actually got a replica of the C64 bread box in this. It's not like somebody took a toaster and slapped a Commodore label on it in this particular case. This is what's exciting about this to me.
Right.
Now, I'm wondering from a market perspective, this is going to be a novelty. So I would think that they're going to have to price it fairly aggressively.
High. It's got dual core Atoms
price
in it.
Or?
To me, it's going to probably be a high price. I mean, I would assume so. And of course, what are we saying? What do we think is high? I'm assuming something like, you know.
I'm going to guess like it'd have to cost, this is just off the top of my head, you know, $600?
Yeah, I was going to say like $499. It's going to have to be something.
Maybe it'll match the original Commodore 64 price, wasn't it $595?
Yeah, no, see, that pricing, I think, is okay with me. I think if you start climbing up the ladder, if you start getting near four digits on this,
it would.
Four figures, it's that would be a harder sell.
Well, yeah, because the people it's going to appeal to will be like, well, I'll just make my own at that point.
I think it's very cool, and I would certainly, I'd love to have one, but, you know, when I moved to the Atlanta area from Florida in July of 2009, I'm off the top of my head, I'm thinking I had two Commodore 64s. I now have at least five. So in the time I've been here, I'd wanted a 64C again, and so I was able to get one of those, like locally Craigslist or something. And then I've had two other ones. I don't even remember now, but I've acquired, you know, it was nothing for me to acquire one more of these. And I'll probably end up selling a couple of them down the road. So,
yep.
So if you really want, so you could have your PC or have your Mac or whatever, and then just have your Commodore 64, you know, or have an emulator, or, I mean, of course, this is gives you the look and feel of the real thing, and then you can really use it as your main computer if you wanted to. I guess you could use it as a media center or something.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
To me, the elephant in the room is that two words that I think of when I think of the Commodore 64 is ergonomically devastating.
Now, they ought to market it. Maybe they could find some specialized marketing. Like, for instance, could this possibly work as like a media center? But then it would have to, like, imagine if it, you know.
Oh, it'd be a great media center. That would be awesome.
But it would have to be able to transmit wirelessly so that you could sit over on the sofa with this in your lap, per se. Oh, but then you'd have to plug it in, so I don't know.
Yeah, but there's no question. If it's a modern PC, that's out of the question. It's not a problem because it's going to have the USB and it's going to have 6 billion other things. I mean, that's not, you know.
Well, I mean, if you use a wireless keyboard or something, it kind of kills the whole, you know, using it.
Well, I would argue that would make it more usable. What's that Commodore 64? Oh, that's the media station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it does more than, just like what made Commodore 64 the multi-million dollar selling computer, it has to do something now other than just being shaped like one in today's modern world that will make it a multi-million dollar computer again. And that means it has to do something at a lower cost price point. The Commodore 64 and the VIC-20 were the things that drove the Atari and a number of other smaller vendors out of business. And a $199 fully functional modern computer with plenty of memory, storage, space, add-ons, and hooks to everything in the social media world, etc., would bring Commodore back.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's funny. In the verbiage for their website, it says it comes in the original brown beige with other colors to follow. And I'm like, really? So do you really think the market for a pink Commodore 64 is going to be huge? Like, I'm just trying to think of, like, what other colors?
Right.
All right. Well, whatever. You know, it's like, good luck, guys. I might just take an interest in getting one myself with that kind of interesting cachet of having a Commodore 64 that secretly does something of use.
But we'll follow it and see what happens. It's certainly interesting. And it looks like, at least from these pictures, if it comes out looking this nice and this authentic, then good job.
Like a computer graphics generated model? Yeah. That's true. No dust, gleaming forever.
All right, our next item is just something short here. It's the Oregon Trail computer game becomes a live-action movie trailer. So basically, you know, this will be, you know, our listening audience can't watch this, but there'll be a link in the show notes for this. honestly, in my work up to our show here, I haven't had a chance to look at it. I kept meaning to, but some good discussion. Looks like it's funny, just kind of a funny, humorous thing. Anyone get a chance to look at it yet?
I saw a little bit of the shots. That's about it.
I guess it's meant to be, you know, a comedy thing.
I guess the most encouraging thing is that a group thought that Oregon Trail was still a relevant enough topic to make fun of, and that kind of makes me happy. How that game has survived the years as being a standard part of someone's computer experience for a lot of people.
It was around forever.
Mm-hmm. Any of you guys ever play it?
I did. Yeah, a long time ago. I think I played the Mac version, an early Mac version, like System 7 time frame.
I feel really bad because I'm an Oregonian and I've never played the game. So that's it. Today I'm hauling it out.
Exactly.
It's a student-oriented game.
Yeah.
It's a resource management game. Yeah.
She taught on Franklin computers, and she ran Oregon Trail with the students in computer lab.
Earlier this year, I ate some bad turkey, and I went to the hospital with what turned out to be an intestinal infection. And I had about five doctors come in, and, you know, doctors, they come in and they say various things, and then later someone else will come in, and usually, like, one of them will say something so completely out of the loop, you're like, oh, God, and then the other one's like, oh, no, it's just a cold. And this one guy, and he was a young doctor, came in and said, yeah, you appear to have dysentery.
Ah.
And the thing is I've gone ahead and looked it up, by the way. To say somebody has dysentery is like telling you that you have hysteria. Like, it's an old medical term that has since become 100 other known conditions. Like, you wouldn't use it. It's like telling somebody, oh, you have some sort of brain loopiness. The vapors. Like, you wouldn't do it yet. The vapors. Consumption.
And
the fact that a doctor in 2010 would say, oh, yeah, looks like dysentery, was just the silliest thing. His cute way of saying, I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's in your gut.
Isn't the vapors what people got here in the Atlanta area?
Oh, yeah.
Is what women got in the Civil War or something?
Oh. But when the show got really, really racy, like somebody would come over and say, well, good damn, lady. And be like, oh, God, the vapors. But anyway, no. So as soon as I mentioned on Twitter that I had dysentery, I got sent a custom T-shirt with Oregon Trail on it saying, I survived dysentery from a fan. And a whole bunch of people sent modified Oregon Trail references because that is one of the most classic ways to die in Oregon Trail is of dysentery. It's like just the way, like it's kind of like the second joke after Oregon Trail. So there's, you know, it's been comedically made fun of for years. So I'm saying a bit too much about this, but what are you going to say, man? Dysentery.
Earl, were you raised in Oregon?
No, I actually grew up in L.A. And
but you lived there a while.
I've lived in Oregon since 1994.
And okay,
so, yeah.
So it is Oregon.
I wasn't going to mention it.
I think there's been times in my life I thought it was Oregon.
No, just Oregon. Sorry.
That's okay. So the next thing is from Ives Bolo, and I follow him on Twitter. Ives, that's his Twitter name. So it's the Ives Bolognini, and he retweeted from Viznut. It says, finally, a proper hardware-banging demo for Commodore PET. And I thought this was just really cool. Obviously, it's not just audio. It's, you know, it's a video, which is important. Link is in the show notes for our listeners. But I want to try to play just a 20 seconds or so of it. So let me have to change my microphone here. Let me try that. Let's try it. I was blown away at this. Now, does he say exactly what Commodore PET it is? I'm assuming, you know, there's been lots of them. It's not necessarily the earliest one.
It works on a PET 4032.
Bill.
Yeah.
How'd you find that out?
This is actually a release demo from the demo scene. That is to say, this whole collection of people who do computer graphics tricks.
Yeah.
And so I saw this a few days before because it kind of burst out. It just got released this month. and
it's
on
amazing.
There,
even for
inevitably the creator will show up, put his thumbs into his armpits, and go like, "Oh, did I mention it's on this? Using this? Did I mention this?" So they dumped all the info. I'll make sure you have a link to that discussion page.
But you said it's a 4032, which has 32K, right?
Right, it's a 32K demo.
And I think that's the pet I have, which has the real numeric key, has real keys.
You have to have hardware add-ons to make this work. There's no way that a standard stock pet would do this.
Uh-oh. You think?
Oh, yeah.
Well, in any case, so it's on YouTube, and I'll put the link in the show notes. And no comments?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it's like the demo supports a SID card, you see.
Oh.
If anyone is listening to this has a copy, send it to me. I'll run it on my 4032.
Well, they have it where you can download it on
right.
the, on the YouTube.
About actually running it on a real.
Right. No, they have a link to all the different stuff. So I've got that in the show notes now, which I think you can put on the site.
I'd love to be wrong, but I just have a feeling that
it's funny. I've seen demos written for oscillators. I've seen demos written for I've seen MP3 generation on a Commodore 64. People are really committed to trying to engineer some of these things and creating like ways of looking at it, obviously using 20 years or 30 years of knowledge about a platform. There's a couple groups who do things for the Atari 2600 that are really amazing. You'd see them and you're like, I can't believe this is a 4K cartridge. And for people like yourself, what they do is they say, here you go, download this image, put it onto a real one and check it out. And sometimes, you find out, well, like for instance, the oscillator demo, you have to have a certain setting on the oscillator or it won't work, but it works.
And Bill, if it's the holidays and we're all going to be real busy, and I understand if it doesn't happen but maybe if you can follow up with me, if you do find out something in regards to that, I can update the show notes.
If in a way, I guess this is a backhand compliment if it is, and I certainly don't. I would love it to be. I don't want to sound negative. I just, from my workings with these and the games that I've seen in the assembly language, backing off memory off of from assembly language programs, there's just a limited amount of space that you can hold something, or where you would need to load additional memory. So 32K just could be used up very quickly, considering that you have to have BASIC and the video routines already in RAM, leaving you maybe 20 something K available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The program appears to have an unpacker, so it actually does things to get around it. It's funny, and I just happen to know a lot about the demo scene, which is why I'm talking more than I really should. I'm just saying what they do is, a lot of times what these guys do is they really do crazy tricks to get the most out of it. And that's the pride. That's the part that you're talking about, where you try it, and if it doesn't work, then you get to go, you didn't quite nail it. Or other times you go, oh my God. And that to them is the greatest compliment, is for someone to say, oh, it's, you're doing something, you're tricking us. You're tricking us. There has to be a trick here. Like, I've had to actually disconnect computers from networks to prove to people that it wasn't live streaming it from a nearby site, because people just don't believe what they're seeing. And that's like the core. It's a beautiful, fascinating little subculture that people want to impress other human beings with programming prowess. Not how well they dance, not how well they sing, how well they program. So, that's to me the glory of it. But either way, it's a beautiful demo.
Well, guys, since we're going a little long on the show, what I want to do is mention two items here and then two other ones that we can discuss briefly. So the first one is from Christian, and I don't have his last name available.
Leando?
Yeah. Okay, and he has a great blog called The 8-Bit Aficionado, and so he has YouTube videos, just all kinds of different holiday, specifically Christmas-related demo videos and games. I think he even has a couple of like Hanukkah and just holiday-related too, which is a lot of fun to look at. So that'll be in the show notes for everyone to check out. And then secondly is Ken Gagne from the Kansas Fest. He announced who the 2011 keynote speaker is going to be, which is Bob Bishop, co-founder of Apple's R&D lab. And so there'll be a link to that. Read more. KFest is, of course, the Apple II. Jason, didn't you go to one of those too? Or you presented one of those last year or this year or whatever?
I was the keynote 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay.
I felt really bad. I missed my flight, and I had to get out of there. So I basically flew in like the morning, did my presentation / keynote, and then left the next morning at like 6 a.m.
I'm sure they were still happy to have had you there.
I can't compliment and promote that event enough.
Yeah, I really
hope
to go this year.
It's the most amazing thing. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like summer camp. It's like, if you've never been to it, you don't understand what the fuss is about quite. You sort of understand, but then you go and you're like, wow.
And Earl, did you say you were planning on going? You're trying to go this year?
I would like to get to one of the Kansas Fests. I don't know if it's going to happen this coming year.
It starts July 19th in 2020.
No, the event's going to happen.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to get there.
Okay.
Yeah. It's one of those things. It's right. It's like a lot of these places where you're like, do I really have 5 days to spare?
Yeah, there's
no
way I could stay the whole time. But two days at least, maybe.
But if you can, it's amazing. I just can't. You know, I was so pleased. Like, just sitting there talking with these guys, I was like, this is crazy. And you know, your fathers and sons coming, where the fathers are helping the sons program stuff. If a person has something amazing about the Apple II they've come up with, they show it there. They pull it up and go, look what I've come up with, a new graphics format. Or I've been able to, like, basically, there was something just recently where the guy, Twitter. He added a Twitter client for the Apple II.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, it would create a low graphics mode version of the icon of the avatar and then use the text on the bottom for the Twitter. It was like,
I think someone did that. Didn't someone in March do something like that too, Bill, with Twitter? Maybe
we were talking about
Commodore 64, maybe, or
doing it on the PDP-8 or something.
But now they did something. They changed something in Twitter, or it won't work.
Yeah,
if I remember correctly.
Well, they require a new type of authentication. I think you have to be able to support encryption to do it. Was that
it?
And so,
I think so.
Tying into that API would be kind of rough for our old 8-bits.
It actually wouldn't be that hard, not to drag this out. It actually wouldn't be that hard. All you have to do is you have to have a key, and you're going to probably need a bridging machine.
Yeah, you'd have to have a bridging machine.
That's about the only, bummer.
In fact, it's not that really difficult to do. You're right.
So, I had to rewrite the client for my cat because it could no longer interact with the cat program that creates the Twitter. So you have to register your application. So I registered a client called Litterbox. And so now he tweets from Litterbox all the time. And people are like, where's this Litterbox client? Where do I get it? This is amazing. I want my cat to Twitter. And I'm like, sorry, one off. Custom.
All right. So let's see. The other thing we wanted to talk about or mention just briefly is there's currently an Apple Lisa 1 up on eBay. So as of right now, it's got 3.5 days left. It's got 6 bids. It's up to $25,100. Can you believe that?
Good luck.
I mean, it's up to that. These people are buying it. Someone's going to buy it for that. Apparently, it doesn't boot. I guess it doesn't have a hard drive. It has the two Twiggies, and that's probably not too big a problem. I guess it just matters that it's a functional Lisa 1. It comes on. Screen works. It's got a keyboard. Doesn't have a mouse. That'll set you back another $100.
Well, there is also a mouse for sale.
For $100?
Well, if you've already spent $25,000,
you know, this comes on the tails of the Apple One auction, and it's been a few other crazy auctions and that haven't sold. And we're going to go over some of the from last shows, the eBay auctions. $25,000, I just don't think it's worth it.
It opened at $7,500, so that's kind of a thing to you got to remember that too. Mm-hmm. It was priced to say, oh no, this is going to be a little expensive if you decide to buy it.
When I went to the Vintage Computer Festival in California in 06, so November 06, I have some pictures where a person there had two Lisa 1s.
Yeah, it was a really interesting-looking woman.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Very, very, very strange to have this woman with these boots and long legs, very beautiful.
Uh-huh. And she had a lot of other Lisa stuff, too.
Yeah, her name was Lisa, and she was like she looked like a model, and she was dressed really like hot geek girl kind of thing.
She's sitting on a landmine.
And she just like walked in with these two Apple Lisas and kind of plunked them in the middle. In fact, it was next to my exhibit space. I was doing an exhibit with Evan on mobile or on the history of early computing or something. And
yeah, with like the loops or.
I just couldn't believe it was just weird how all these kind of dorky guys are showing their computers and in walks this woman with these Lisa that she keeps in her kitchen. She was just telling me, you know, she just keeps them in her kitchen, uses them.
And I said she's sitting on a landmine. I meant gold mine.
Yeah.
Oh, a lot of gold mines turn into landmines, given enough time, believe me.
Okay, so the last item of interest or news is from off a retro thing, which is one of my favorite blogs. And of course, he dabbles in a little bit of computer history-related stuff, but all kinds of things retro. But it's an article and a picture here about a scratch-built 8-bit retro computer. And if you guys have looked at the pictures, it's pretty neat. Matt Sarnoff, I've designed my own 8-bit computer using the somewhat obscure Motorola 6809 processor, wired it all up by hand, and wrote the operating system, drivers, and the rest of the software all in assembly language. Jeez. It runs at a blazing 2 megahertz, has a spacious 512K of RAM, and can read files and run programs from a compact flash card.
Yeah, and you know, the creator, Matt Sarnoff, the creator, he only graduated from Carnegie Mellon Computer Science in 2008.
Really?
So, you know, obviously this is a guy who, he learned all the right things at school as far as I'm concerned.
It's just so neat. I mean, he's even got an expansion bus on the thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love these kind of things because what fascinates me is when you have someone, and I'm using young in a relative term, okay, because I'm 40. I'll run into somebody who's young, and to them, this wasn't their childhood. This is a historic – this would be like if we went around and said, you know, let's try to rebuild an old steam engine. Like, it's not like we're going like, oh, we're harkening back to when Dad used to load me up and put the coals in. I mean, you're doing it because it's this – almost foreign idea you're trying to get closer to. And for him, these computers are this foreign historical thing, and he's gone ahead and wanted to do it, but he has imbued in him present sensibilities. So he looks at computers a certain way and wants them. I had somebody who made an adventure game based on computer bulletin board history, and she had been born 1 year after the events in the game, which was 1988. So you'll have somebody for whom it's literally historical fiction. And so for him, he's like, I'm going to recreate this. So, you know, the name is the Ultimate 09. Why? It's because he thinks that's what a machine should be called. And so on. And it's a beautiful little piece of hackery.
Yeah, I think he's it's his walk in nostalgia. And he's doing something, you know, he's doing something now that, of course, if he had lived at that time, he probably would have done then. Like, I could never do this because, first of all, I'm not a hardware person or an engineer, and I'm not a programmer. But, you know, my whole interest in the hobby started because, in my own way, I'm also doing what I would have done then. You know, maybe it would only have been buying the computers and using them and messing around with them. But, you know what I'm saying? It's the same thing. I wished I had lived then, and it would all have been fresh and new and interesting. And so, okay, why don't I do that now? It's still, people are throwing this stuff out.
So they are, you know, they're doing this kind of thing. One of the Retrobits listeners wrote me an email, and he puts together 8-bit computer systems. He'll design the board layout for it, have a board created through Express PCB, and then get the board, solder in all the components, write an operating system. You know, maybe it'll be a Z80-based system. He'll crank out a version of CPM for it. He had a really innovative idea, which was to take these boards and stick them in an old ATX case so that you'd automatically have a housing and a power supply. And I mean, if you're a geek who doesn't have a couple of ATX cases laying around that were the hulk of an old computer that you had that no longer functions or whatever. But anyway, just interesting how he would concoct all this stuff and put it all together. I could never do anything like that, but it's fascinating that there's a lot of that still going on.
Well, like I've built the Vince Briel's Replica 1, so I could do that. And so I've dabbled in those kind of kits, and I have my Altair Micro here, which I haven't built yet, shamefully. Was very excited to have it, and I will build it. It's something I'm going to do on my video podcast. And so again, this is something maybe... Tell you the truth, I don't know if I could have built an original Altair 75, but I can do this. It'll take some time. But all nostalgic kind of hobby sort of things are somewhat like that, I guess.
Yeah, guys like this always make me happy because, you know, I used to think, who's going to be the next Lumberjacks? Who's going to want that job? And yet somehow, young guys go out and be Lumberjacks.
Yeah.
And you go, who's going to hack the hardware? You know, people constantly tell themselves, oh, well, now that it's the App Store instead of the Apple II, we're never going to have those kind of kids. And here's a kid who's like, can I stick my hand in that and create something that predates him that functions really well? I see he made a Sega USB adapter.
Well, and things that were fun are still fun to certain people.
Exactly.
So whether it was, you know, not common anymore or not even practical. Well, now we're going to move into the eBay auctions. So very quickly here, I'm going to just talk about what we were one panelist down last show, so everybody did two auctions. So there's six here, and I'm going to go very quickly through them to say how they ended. So Michael Nadeau had two. So his first one was called the and the links are in the show notes for the previous ones as well. So I started doing that now. So it was called the APF Imagination Machine plus 14 games and education programs. It has, as of this moment, 3 hours and 37 minutes to go with a buy it now off price of $9,999.99 or make an offer. And so no one has done that. And then his next one was a vintage MSI VDP-80 business computer Intel 8085. So it ended on December 11th for $676.77 with two bids.
You know, I don't think that was a bad price.
No, it's pretty rare, I would think. Well, it's kind of beat up, though, but you could replace those keys, I would
what
imagine.
What was the price again?
$676.77.
That's a collector price. You're gonna have to put at least that much into it to get it running again.
Don't forget that $135 shipping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it shows for me too.
That was somebody who wants the MSI name. There's a lot of computers that are similar in the 8085 world that you could get for $25.
Well, I think this machine represents, if I'm not mistaken, the last of the MSI. Well, there's the VDP-40, but essentially, you know, this is one of the machines that brought them down too. Yeah. So it's somewhat significant.
I just think that there are people who, and again, I want to make sure I say this in a way that's not hurting anybody's feelings, but the name brings you the value really more so than it, the MSI long ago at that point had lost its historical significance.
Mm-hmm.
And really, what you're doing is you're latching on to that name when it really is just a Me Too computer at that point, because they're really just trying to, you know, they're saying, oh, we'll use the 8085, we'll try to hold on to the business market, and what they originally accomplished, which was a copy of the Altair, became irrelevant because the Altair was no longer being sold either. So it's
I think you're right. I think
it's a testament to the fact that people should be careful of what they collect, and that from a long-term standpoint, holding the value of something just because it says MSI isn't necessarily good strategy.
I would say, though, Bill, out of all the S100 computers, that, you know, Altair, I guess, is probably the most significant overall. But I would have to say MSI is probably, I don't know if it's necessarily the second most significant, but it's up there. I mean, then you have processor technology, and arguably different ones are more collectible, but it's certainly one of the more significant, you know, out of that, you know, class of computers.
Right. No, the name I'm saying that that doesn't necessarily make it
valuable.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are giving it value rather than it having deserving the value.
But it's all perceived. Jason, you're going to say something?
No. No comment.
Okay. All right, well, let's move along. So James Savage was on our show last time. He's from the Retro MacCast, so he had two picks. And the first one was a transparent Mac SE, which did not sell for $25,000. Why not?
Why has the world let us down?
That's a shame. But the second pick he had, the Mac Colby, rare first portable Macintosh, 1984, big lot, it says. It sold after 24 bids for $5,400. And, you know, interesting, after that podcast, I have like a banner. If you look at my webpage, you know, it says Classic Computing. I have this like banner I made. It's got a bunch of little pictures in it that I've been using since, I don't know, 98 or something, 99. And it actually has a black and white little picture of that machine in there. I knew I'd seen it before, not just on a webpage. Any comments on that? That seems like a lot, even though it is very rare. And I guess it's technically the first Mac portable, not by Apple.
Where was the location of the buyer?
Oh, it doesn't tell you that, I don't believe. Let's see. I don't even know if it tells you. You know, eBay's locked down a lot of stuff. Yeah, they even block out who the buyer is. Oh, look, surprisingly, they actually give you the different bid totals. I thought they'd block that out.
Yeah, they tweak things back and forth. For a while, they used to block them, but then they brought them in to prevent accusations of fraud.
Yeah, you know, you can't learn anything about the... I think if you did a search, Well, let's try this. If I do a search for the seller, and you have to be logged in to do
this. You can certainly see what else they've bid on.
Well, and you can look at feedback. So let's try this a second. So I go to advanced search, or I could do it through feedback, and I want to look by bidder. So now, oh wait, no, this is the seller. So if I search for the seller's ID, I guess I'd have to go to feedback and do a search that way, and who he's left feedback on. Anyway, I won't bother.
You know, I think you're right about the perceived value, David. I mean, I look at this particular model, and I think if I had this in my living room, it would have to be important specifically to me. Because if somebody walked up and was asking me, well, what is that and what's it all about, it wouldn't be obvious to them why I had collected it. I mean, it's not – I think probably a good number of people in the vintage computer world would look at that and not – it wouldn't resonate with them right off the top. But you know, it depends on what niche you're in. For instance, if you saw an auction for one of the few remaining Commodore 65 prototypes –
Right.
A lot of people would look at that and it wouldn't resonate with them. It's like, you know, what's that? But to a Commodore person, this is one of the Holy Grail type of, you know, models that you would love to have in your collection, even though it never came out in a production sense, you know, kind of famous in the Commodore community, but more or less just in that niche. That's got to be what this is. Because, I mean,
there's a story behind this, too. Colby designed them. He was close to the Macintosh brains that were there when the thing was invented, so it's value by association.
See, that's what I mean. You'd have to know that story, and you do know that story, so that's something that would be significant in that context.
Look, I found the buyer by doing going to the feedback forum, you know, doing a search for the seller, then putting it in order of his feedback. So the buyer is Randoms3. He's got 1580 feedback, 100%. So he's in the United States, member since February 25th, 2002.
He's a huge buyer of vintage computing. I mean, his collection may be one of the largest.
Okay. Well, you know, and the other relative thing to the perceived value is also how much money do you have? I mean, so, you know, I could want something, and obviously I only have so much money. If I really wanted that Matt Colby and $5,000 wasn't that much to me, then I guess, you know, I might spend that much in relative to how much.
Spent tens of thousands of dollars a year.
Yeah. That guy does?
Yeah. If I'm remembering him correctly, he's a really big IBM mainframe guy. I've seen him appear many times. But he must have a museum like you would not believe.
You know, I mean, I got this guy who, when I was working on the movie about text adventures, a Zork 1, or as I should say, a Zork manual for the PDP-11 that had been, it's basically printed on 8.5 by 11 paper. It happens to have three of the signatures of three of the creators of Zork on the front, and it went for $2,348.
Mm-hmm.
And
he bought
I know who bought it. No, he didn't buy it. I mean, but I'm saying I know who bought it. He turned around, immediately scanned it to PDF, and mailed it to me.
Wow.
So I asked him, like, what's the deal? And he said essentially that it was important to him that that history be saved and that it be put into a place that made sense. And, you know, like a couple years later, he actually divested a lot of his collection. Mm-hmm. But he divested it in a manner where he was ensured it would stay cohesive and move on to the next place. But if you could, it's very hard to argue about basically a 50-page 8.5 by 11 stapled manual for $2,300 without some people using phrases like crazy and too much money, because it's just one of those natures of things. And then you'll find out it's because in that person's value system, that's not a lot for what that represents. Like, it's amazing. And a lot of times it's what you write. How well do you write your description? If you look at that entry for the Colby, it says basically, the Computer History Museum only has a keyboard. I mean, that's an interesting appeal to a person to say, you can outdo a museum.
And don't forget the other secret of eBay. It's, now, guys, don't spread this around a lot, but it's the word rare. if you used the word rare.
I thought it was the word look with zeros in it.
One of my representative objects will be my example of rare. Another good phrase is one of a kind.
Collectible.
Collectible's okay, because that usually gets one certain kind, but one of a kind.
Yeah.
Unique plus computer is a good search when somebody tries to indicate that what they have is the only kind of computer of its sort.
The last two auctions from last time were my picks, and so one of them is called the Largest Vintage Computer Collection, over 600 items. It had no bids at the starting bid of $18,000. It was located in Hayward, California. I don't see where it's been relisted. Moving along, so the last one is the Vintage Brainiac K30 Computer Circuits Lab. So it had five bids, ended at $127.50, which pretty good deal, in my opinion, for what it was, because that's pretty rare. Edmund C. Berkeley. If you've never heard of him.
This is a really bad time to be selling, especially at Thanksgiving, and Christmas. You have to really be careful. This is probably worth more. This is a good deal. Probably, I've seen these.
$100 or so more, I think, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Bill, you go ahead and talk about your this time's auction.
Okay, well, I really, frankly, saw nothing that was that wonderful. And I saw some things. I didn't see anything that was really spectacular. So I thought instead I would just briefly discuss a concept that I've come up with called the Mickey Mantle effect on eBay. And I can illustrate that with the number of Altairs that you see almost all the time. Despite the fact that these were very rare computers, it's very unrare to see. It's very rare to not see one on eBay. And I think the reason for that, people will throw away their regular baseball cards, but they'll save the Mickey Mantle and put it in their drawer. And I think that's what's happened with the Altairs. Everyone's, over many years, has thrown away every computer they've ever owned except for their Altair, the first one they made. And these are now showing up on eBay. There has been no let up in the availability of getting them. If you're willing to spend increasingly more money, but certainly they're much rarer S100 systems, like the Polymorphic, which was sold about a week or so ago. That would have been my good example.
The one that was in the same sort of case, like the processor technology.
Yeah, it was more like a bread. It looked like more like a bread box, okay. But not flat like a Commodore 64, but more like on its side, like a toaster.
Mm-hmm.
That computer came out. It was called the Micro Altair to start with. They were sued by Mintz.
Right. Yeah.
And they changed it to the Polymorphic 88. The Micro Altair would be incredibly valuable. Yet I wonder if you'd be able to get $2,000 or something like that. But there's a few companies, the Sphere, the HAL. I have a list of them on my website that really you never see on eBay. And so that's my illustration of the Mickey Mantle effect.
Yeah, there's three Altairs right now. One's a turnkey, and the other two are the original 8800s. And those guys are over $5,000 by it now.
Right, and I think that they're just, trying to get whatever money they can. I don't think it's a realistic price. But I'd be interested to see, and I have saved them just to see what happens with them. But the one auction that I chose was the 75 Popular Electronics Altair 680 computer kit, just to show that the 680 Altair is really one of the ones to really be on the lookout for, especially memory cards and peripherals and expansion for those. That was a computer that was marketed. If you look at the marketing literature at the time, the woman would be holding the 680 and the man would be holding the 880 in the poster. And, it just didn't sell very well. The SWTPC 6800, which is a contemporary of the Altair 680, same processor, sold much better. That was their big computer. But Altair did have a 6800 processor system. And something like that would really be interesting to see how well that would do on eBay. But you just don't see the Altair 880A, where it actually has the A on it, and the Altair 680. It's a shame that all you ever see are just the 880s, and it just makes me wonder who's really valuing these things. And I'm almost saying there should be a call for a grading system or some sort of non-subjective, that's kind of a silly thing to even say, but there's the Christmas season brings out a lot of these people trying to make their Christmas present money, and you're going to get a lot of these Mickey Mantle type computers out.
Okay. That's actually not a bad deal for the magazine if you can only pick it up for $10.
Right.
All right, Earl, you go ahead.
Well, my eBay pick, and, you know, from both it being interested in this specific item and just a general concept, was this Apple IIc that is purported to be new in box. And it's interesting to me that there's one bid on it so far for $20. It says the reserve is not met. They've got to buy it now for just at about $5,000. And so, you know, I think that price is probably not going to happen. But, you know, who knows? Again, stranger things have happened. At one point, I had purchased a Commodore 16, which is not as well known of a Commodore model. It was a contemporary of the Commodore Plus 4, which is a little bit more well known, the Commodore 8-bit systems that had what was called the TED chip. Anyway, when I purchased
black.
it was black. Yeah, it's like a chocolate-covered VIC-20, if you could imagine that. And when I got it, it was supposedly new in box. And I purchased it for $35, so I didn't pay a lot of money for it. When I got it, it sure looked like it was new in the box. To me, there was no way I could tell whether it was or wasn't. But that made me think, gosh, how do I really know? What if it's something that had been taken out and played with a bit, but then kind of nicely put back in the box with the little tie wraps and everything and made to look like it was new in box and then sold out? It didn't matter. I didn't pay an exorbitant amount of money for it. And in this particular case with the Apple IIc that's saying it's in sealed boxes, the seller has 100% positive feedback, you know, 1,752 feedbacks total. So I have no reason to believe in this particular case that the computer isn't new in the box with the factory tape. But I wanted to put it out to you guys and say, when you're buying something that's new old stock, purportedly, how do you really know? I mean, I wondered with the Commodore 16, how do I really know this was a computer that I was unboxing for the first time, or was it something that was just in really good condition and reboxed up and then sold to be new old stock? At $35, I didn't care that much. If I was going to do a buy it now for $5,000 to be the proud owner of, you know, a brand new old stock Apple IIc, I'd kind of want to know that.
And I guess it matters, or I guess it matters to some people and doesn't matter to other people. For $5,000, I guess this would really matter. And there, in recent years, there's been a few of these. There's been a couple, like an Apple II. I don't even remember specifically now. Maybe it was even Apple IIc, where, you know, the whole big deal of buying it and then filming the unboxing and all that kind of stuff. Do you guys remember that? There was like a, it was some, I think some
I
kind
do
of
remember
Apple
that.
II, maybe a couple of years ago for like $2,500.
Yep.
But I guess it matters, you know, would you pay this much if you just always wanted the experience of a brand new Apple IIc and then, right, you're going to film it, the unboxing. But see, because me, I really wouldn't care less if something was brand new, but I would care about its condition. So if it was like new, you know, I would pay a little more than that for that. But, you know.
You could put an ultraviolet light on it and you'd be able to tell if there's fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's crafty.
That's what I would do.
You know, it's funny because we were talking about before the show, I think, about how some of these attributes of other collectors, groups, and things are going to slowly leak into computer collecting, up to and including, in my opinion, falsified, you know, forged older machinery and grading systems and so on. So I think what's going to happen is that if you look at how people buy horses, there's a whole variety of things. Like there's insurance that you maintain for the time from when the horse is immediately bought by you at auction to when it comes under your possession at the stable. And if computer equipment that's getting older starts to get up into the $5,000 and $10,000 range, that's when it becomes really profitable to do those things, and you'll find suddenly all these other services reaching out. You know, try to be the one guy with the monocle saying, but father, there's money to be made, and convincing them to kind of reach out to the computer community and go, oh, do you need it graded? We can do that.
I kind of think some fraud has occurred, if I'm not mistaken, too. Wasn't there...
on eBay?
Well, specifically with a retro computer where there are a... There's been some people over the years that make authentic, absolute reproductions of Apple I's down to the level where, you know, there's no way to almost know that it wasn't reproduced. I mean, unless you were a true expert to go down to all the chips and look at cross-reference their production dates and different things. And even then, you could acquire old chips. If I'm not mistaken, I thought something like that had happened with a reproduction Apple I.
Right. Well, even in lower cost things, I read about reproduction SID chips that either didn't work or, you know, they were mislabeled intentionally or something like that, because the SID being a popular music chip, people wanted to get them for these add-on boards that are produced that support the SID chip, and you'd buy it and then find out, uh-oh, I got ripped off. It's not even a SID chip. It was So, I mean, you're right that sort of thing is starting to happen.
Yeah, and it's just something, I mean, it's in one way, it's good. It's a sign that these computers are being recognized as being valued items, but it means that you just can't assume that what you're getting is what you're really, really getting. And when you're getting up to that level, some of the things that we perhaps don't think of when we think of a computer auction, like saying, well, actually, we have to have this graded by a third party before I'll finally accept it, and we'll put it in escrow. I think we'll start, you know, it's a little bit of a bother, but if you're paying $25,000 for a computer.
Or even $5,000.
Yeah.
Even $5,000, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you probably want to spend the extra $125 for all the pain just to be sure. Because, I mean, yeah, here's a case where here's a box. You know, but also, I must say, the one you've linked here, I mean, this guy really worked on the copy.
Absolutely. And like I say, I don't have any reason to suspect this is not true new old stock.
I don't want to imply that either, but I do want to say that part of its success would be this beautiful verbiage. I mean, nobody's biting, but, you know, that verbiage is beautiful. Like, this is where it was found. Here's the story of it. Here's why you'd want it. You know, this guy's working it. He's trying to get the story out.
And they may not be biting because it just came up. I mean, I was searching on the newly listed area of eBay because I wanted something where when people would listen to the podcast, maybe they could still catch it while the auction was even still going on. If I will say a couple things just to close this out. I like when I can get new old stock, but I don't think I would buy something for a collectible sort of purpose with new old stock. Like, there's still an outfit in Colorado where you can get Epson PX8 CPM laptops, which are fun to me because I used to work at Epson in those days. And you can get them for $100, and they really are new in the box. It's just a company that...
I remember you talking about that on your podcast and in the forum. Retrobits forum, some people...
Yes, awesome. And also, there's a seller, I think, in Venezuela, if I remember right. But somebody... that you can get new old stock Atari systems. I think the Atari 130 8-bit systems, and for, you know, not too bad a price there either. Now, the one thing you'd want to keep in mind, though, with the old 8-bits is quality control wasn't always the best back in those days. You know, you had a fairly decent shot of buying a new computer from a retail outlet, getting it home and having it not work. Imagine your surprise and horror if you paid thousands of dollars for new old stock. I mean, what's your chances of getting the warranty honored?
Well, the old ones are easier to fix, at least. So.
Well, that's true.
Well, Jason, you go ahead now.
Okay. Well, no, there were two of them. There was a real one and a funny one. The funny one is the one where somebody is selling a next computer branded screwdriver, rare. And it's $41 plus $6 shipping. So for $47, you can harken back to your days of opening up a Next computer with a screwdriver.
Yeah, or going to a computer show and then someone handing you a Next branded screwdriver.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like,
think back on those glory days.
You know,
kind.
Well, guess what? You probably have a few $100 worth then, because...
Well, there are all different companies. Not the Next, but of all the various screwdrivers that I've picked up over the years. So
yeah.
Probably, people love these little things to collect.
Yeah. And it's just funny to me because they'll use the phrase like rare. And you could see, I mean, it's on bubble wrap, implying that it's been given the utmost of care. The screwdriver has been given nothing but the finest existence before it.
It probably is rare, though.
It probably is rare. Anyway, so the other thing is another rare item, which was this video game and computer entertainment magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely rare 11th issue.
Finally, the 11th issue has come up for auction.
Yeah, you know, this thing was just a myth because people thought that after the 10th that was it. And then the 12th came out and people were like, where's the 11th? And it was just a myth.
A missing episode.
What I like about it is it's being sold for $29.95. It's on sale for $26.36. And if you look at his other auctions, there's other auctions with completely weird numbers like this, by the way. I mean, like all of his magazines, because all he does is sell magazines, it's like $5.72, $17.56, $26.36. It's all of this stuff. And I guess this guy has a business. And his business is he's selling off piles of magazines for anywhere between $10 and $30 per for buy it now or quote-unquote make offer.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you have all of the discomforting experience of walking into a store and trying to haggle with somebody.
He's got 1,009 items.
Yeah, which are all magazines. And, you know, as somebody who gets sent these, I mean literally just sent these, convincing people that I'll pay the postage, it's funny to me to see somewhere else somebody is trying to actually, like, make a business, because he tells his origin story. We're a new company that started in July, 2009, we have these old vintage magazines, they're in great condition, and you know, they'll bring back a lot of memories. A video game collector's dream come true. You know, it's very interesting verbiage. I'm always fascinated at the whole eBay culture of how do you convince people your junk is worth getting? How do you apply extremely rare to a 1985-era magazine with any knowledge? There's no place to find that out. There's no market for that.
You know, yet. And from my experience of, you know, using eBay, probably less so over the last number of years, but for 12 years or so, there's been very, very – now, obviously, this is just in my own experience and things I'm looking at, but there's been very few times when something – I've only seen something once, and it's never, ever come back again. I mean, it has happened, but generally speaking, if you want something and you watch it, and then you're dedicated to keep looking for it, it'll come up again. You'll find
right.
it again.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we're telling people basic stuff, but the funny part to me is that person who is interested in computer stuff. Sometimes you'll get people who are – I'm always about bridging to new people. And so what happens is somebody has a memory of something computer-wise, and as like a newly minted starling, fresh from the egg, they walk into the eBay bazaar with its lack of terrible smells and scary-looking alleyways, and instead a beautiful white background with a multicolored logo. And they wander over and they're like, I remember this item from my youth. And they don't look at the shipping amount.
Yep.
And they buy an item.
Evil shipping.
And then they're like, wow, I only paid $6 plus $47. And it's like, as somebody who's collecting these items, I take a special interest in this because I'll have cases where, to many people, I mean, I'm not giving away a big hint here, but here's your hint. People like to get rid of everything at once, not have people come and cherry pick things. And I have gotten more old collections that way because it's like people will be like, okay, I'll start sorting through. And I'm like, don't sort through. Just send me everything. And that's, for instance, how I got, and I refuse to justify this, all of Randall Schwarz's old shirts. One of the guys behind Pearl, he put up a picture of, look at all these old shirts I'm throwing out. And somebody said, Jason Scott should get those shirts. And talking about me summons me, and I showed up and said, you betcha, here you go. Please send the shirts. And I took the shirts. I took some photos of these old shirts that he'd been given for free and he never wore at all these conventions. And people are responding immediately like, oh, my God, I remember that company. Or what about that place? And so,
yeah, you got to freak them out and tell them that you sleep in a different one every night.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm like, it's historically important, and it's a new wardrobe.
It's incredibly comfortable.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's my riff off of something like an extremely rare video game.
Well, and you guys are going to make me drag out all my old Comdex buttons. I'm going to have to start wearing a different one every week.
And they're collectible. Well, let me get to the last auction. We're running long here. So the last one is by the one I chose. It's an old Commodore MOS Technology 6502 Kim 1 SBC computer. Has 5 days, 6 hours left, 9 bids, $112.50. So I guess I'll give a couple of common sense sort of advice to anybody wanting to buy stuff from eBay. Is first, like anything else that you buy, you should know how much money you want to spend. And pretty much say, this is all I can afford, this is all I want to spend, and don't go above that. And typically, what I've found is what happens too, is like something shows up, hasn't been there in a while, and then it gets a lot of, let's say it sells for $300. You wait a week or so, even a few days, and guess what? All of a sudden, three have come out of the closet from other people because they want to make their $300. Chances are you're going to pick them up far cheaper. But then always you should go and look at completed auctions and see what things are selling for first before you even start bidding. And write and bid at the last minute. I did a quick search for a Kim 1, and I found, so one sold recently on the 6th of December for $330 without looking at it too much other detail. So maybe, $300 is kind of the going rate for one of those. So currently $112, maybe that's not bad.
Can you tell if it's a Commodore branded or a MOS branded?
Let's see. It only has the one picture. You can enlarge it, see how big it gets. It doesn't really get much bigger. It's a pretty clear picture. It says Kim 1. I can't tell.
No, you can tell me.
Also, does it take a battery or something? How do you power it up?
You'd run the 5 volts up near the where is it? There's leads. I'm just trying to find where they are.
Did the Commodore branded ones actually have the chicken head on there?
Yes.
Did they? Yeah. I'm not seeing that on this photo.
If this is an original, then this is a good case of bad picture. End up selling the item for less than it's actually worth, because if this is a MOS version before Commodore purchased them, then you have reasonable certainty that it's a 1975, and therefore, most of these are fixable, so it's worth more.
Yeah,
it's certainly worth taking more than one flash blown out photo if you really care. I mean,
on the floor.
That's the thing right there too, Jason. You're absolutely right. Any better auction where you're going to get the most, especially for something a collectible, something you're going to get the most, money for what you're selling, you should always take at least a few pictures, and close up bigger ones too.
Yeah, I've found that people if you put something on your auction that causes people to ask questions, you can then almost create a dialogue in your eBay auction that helps you sell it as well.
Right.
Computer people love to tell you how much they know.
Okay. I'm just making sure my recording thing was going here properly. Gosh, technical difficulties. Well, guys, thanks a lot for being so patient with the show today. I'm sorry it went so long. So, Bill, thanks a lot for being on the show. Yeah, and tell us what you're up to.
Just real quickly, I'm getting ready to teach this spring in my History of the Personal Computer class at the University of Delaware, but there are spaces left, so please.
And how do you get – I want to get a job teaching that. I don't know if I'm qualified.
Well, just stop by. I'll let you take over for me for a couple of days.
Adjunct?
Sure. And I just also wanted to make sure that everybody knows about the Vintage Computer Festival in Wall, New Jersey, May 14th and 15th. We'll have exhibits and speakers. I'm not sure who's going to be the speaker, keynote speaker yet. Certainly looking for ideas. Those are the two announcements that I'd like to make.
Okay.
And thank you very much.
And thanks for being back on. And so, Earl, and what's going on in your life? I know you just did an episode, and I think you had announced you're trying to keep about an every 3 week schedule.
Yeah, actually, that's from the retro computing perspective, that's probably the most significant thing is, it's been a show, maybe there'd be a couple in the course of a couple weeks and then not one for a month and a half, and it's been kind of all over the road. So I was looking for a time period that would both work for me and would also give people some idea of, hey, when the heck's a new show coming out? So every 3 weeks is what I'm shooting for, which puts a new show on the air on December 27th, so just after Christmas. And then you know, we'll go from there and see how that goes. From a hobbyist perspective, I do have to mention one of these deals that you never know you're going to bump into. There was somebody selling a pretty rare Commodore disk drive at a garage sale that a buddy of mine picked up. It's called an SFD 1001. Hmm. It looks like an old Commodore 1541, but it is in fact an IEEE 488 drive that connects up to the PET systems. And it's kind of intriguing in that it stores 1 megabyte on one of the old 5 1/4 floppy disks.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a very interesting mechanism. And so it cost us a few dollars for parts. We took it to somebody here in the area that's good at Commodore component level repair. And the drive's up and running now. I'm just either going to purchase or build an IEEE cable to hook it up to my PET. But it's just one of those exciting projects, you know, that make it fun to be in the retro computing world. And it's going to be great to see it light up. And my PET's only got 8K. And, you know, if you store 1 megabyte per disk, that's going to be a lot of programs for the PET.
What was the standard 1540, I guess, was the original, then a 1541? And those are double-sided, correct?
Well, this is an IEEE drive, so this is more the equivalent of the 8250.
Right.
You would only be able to read disks that were for this SFD 1001, or won't work.
No, I understand. Yeah. What is the traditional, you know, Commodore disk drive? How much does it store on either side? Like 120 something?
160, yeah.
Yeah.
I think 170K on a 1541, that was only single-sided, and then their 1571 drive was a double-sided and also had the faster burst mode when you'd connect it to a Commodore 128. But the SFD is pretty rare. I mean, I read on Commodore.ca, I think, that they're thinking maybe only a few hundred of these still exist. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I'd never seen one in person, so actually having one is pretty fun. It's just one of those hobby things that was kind of a highlight for me for the past few weeks.
Well, Jason, what are you – so in closing out, what are your projects right now? Are you done with your tours or whatever?
Yeah.
Was it GitJet? Is that what tours or the GitLamp?
The JetLamp
tour. JetLamp, okay.
Which was wonderful. I spent time in Seattle, Portland, L.A., Salt Lake City – let me get this right. Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, and Denver, New York City, D.C., Texas. I went all over the place and met a lot of people, showed to rooms as small as 3 people and as much as 300, and had a wonderful time.
I wish I could bring you to Atlanta. I'm just not set up or connected enough to, you know.
Number one thing at this point would be flight cost. That's about it. I'd go anywhere.
And I'm
broke. Love talking about this. Exactly. That's the thing. It's one of those, you know, some schools have been able to cover my way and had me come visit them. But I love showing this film. I think it really kind of helps people understand that time in a way that they might not have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And currently I have a part-time job. I'm the historian and an archivist for the Game Developers Conference. They have sent me dozens and dozens and dozens of tapes of people speaking, some of which are no longer with us, from the last roughly 15 years of the Game Developers Conference. And I am transferring them and uploading it to their vault where people can look at them. And so that's what I'm doing.
Thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thank you.
And so we'll be in touch. So I hope everyone can return, you know. So every 3 weeks I'm doing a show, so hopefully we'll even have a couple other panelists into next year. Vince Briel might be one, and Bruce Damer. But, you know, so what is it, every 2 months or so? Hopefully you'll be back on. Well, guys, happy holidays of your choice. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
That was great. Thank you for hosting.
Thanks for listening, and please check the show notes for all the links. Don't forget about my other two podcasts, the Classic Computing Video Podcast and Stan Beat's History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. All 3 of my podcasts can be subscribed to through iTunes. Please help me out by leaving a review in the iTunes store. You can also help support the shows by donating through PayPal. A link is at the bottom of the show notes page. Plus, you can support the shows by using my Amazon.com links for books mentioned and with the search box. Read my blog and follow everything I'm doing at ClassicComputing.com.